On the 31st of January 1990, it is a bitterly cold day in Moscow. The line of people stretches back round the block. Even in a city used to queuing, the length and depth of this patient line of people is remarkable, their breath clouding the chill air. They are not waiting to see Brezhnev lying in state. They are not patiently queuing for the latest batch of new shoes rumoured to have reached the city. They are waiting to buy a McDonald's cheeseburger. Yes, the long tentacles of American culture have reached and breached even the citadel of communism, and the people eagerly get in line for their Big Mac and whatever the Russian is for "Do you want fries with that?" Cultural imperialism in its most naked form. Was this the moment when the first cracks appeared in the Soviet resolve, the smell of hamburgers on the streets of Moscow? Not that there is anything new about cultural imperialism. Before the Americans, it was the British imposing their interpretation of social life on the ethnic patterns of India and Africa. The British Raj, with its assumptions and presumptions, pushing aside as of no worth the indigenous culture they'd come to rule over, dominate and reshape. And long before the British, the Romans had done it, making literal inroads into the most sacred and precious elements of local life within the nations the mighty legions had conquered. And before the Romans, the Greeks, with their self-assured conviction that their culture represented the highest point, the classic achievements of art, thought and morality. The Greeks who built the ancient city of Philadelphia on the borderlands of the mysterious continent of the East, in the hope that Philadelphia would serve as a jumping-off point for all that was good and laudable and worthy within Greek society, and take it to these enigmatic people of the East, so different, so much in need, the Greeks believed, of the sophistication and insight that was their way of doing things. Philadelphia was there on the new frontier for Greek civilization, the doorway to the beckoning East, with its mystery, its riches and its promise. And so the citizens of that city lived on the edges of safety and order, aware of the dangers of venturing too far into the hinterland of the unknown, and yet also challenged by the opportunity the hinterland presented. And it is that theme of opportunity, open now to the church there, that runs through the word of the Lord to Philadelphia, as we read in Revelation. For them, the door of opportunity is wide open to take the good news of the gospel to the uncharted and unchurched lands of the East, a missionary opportunity to bring to the benighted heathen the hope of Christ. Here was a church fired by a vision, thrilled by a challenge, and activated by a love and concern that was enough to keep them awake to the need and brave for the responsibilities. In that respect, it is true that nothing changes. For the missionary call is a real one in today's church and for today's world. And it makes sense here in 21st century Geneva, no less than it did for the Christians all those years ago. For our communities are in the process of upheaval and developments. Uncertainty hangs in the air. In Geneva, new people arrive every week. And there are many, many outside the life of the church, and many only very loosely within its life. We're challenged to reach out to them with the living word of Christ and the good news of hope and healing. Our call is to mission too, just as clear and urgent, and we mustn't duck that responsibility. We can't pretend that there's nothing for us to do. Say, everyone knows we're open for business, so if anyone wants to come looking, they'll know where to find us. Imagine if the first disciples had taken that view. Imagine if the great missionaries had sat at home or stayed cosy in their churches and waited for the world to come to them. Or if Columba had just stayed in Ireland and left the people of Scotland to find their own way to God. That laissez-faire pattern has never been operated within the church. Since the beginning, there has always been an impetus to go out, to take initiatives, to be bothered, to give a damn. And as new generations grow up within our communities, some of whom, a staggeringly large number of whom, have never really heard or understood what a living faith is about, we find ourselves standing on the doorstep of opportunity and with an unavoidable responsibility to echo the missionary endeavour of the early church. Places like Philadelphia and get down to it, get on with it. And how did the church at Philadelphia achieve those high goals? First, they remained faithful to the gospel and to Christ. They knew what they believed, who they followed and why. They stuck to the core message, shared the central truths of the faith, unwaveringly calling people to Jesus Christ, bringing people to Christ. And they didn't lose heart when things got hard. They didn't falter when the demand pressed on their life. Those times when they could have said, "Who needs this? I want my own life, my own timetable, and my freedom." Those times when the pressures mounted and the challenges rained down on them, they showed the spirit of endurance. Not 100-metre sprinters, but engaged in the dogged business of the marathon. Not insisting on a quick return, but patiently working on it, working at it. We know something of that. If we've been in the church over the decades, sometimes it feels both long and a haul. A long haul indeed. The resolve of those early Christians was sustained by the teaching and the understanding they sought and hungered for. They were clearly growing in their grasp of things, sacred things, not content with what we might call a Sunday school grasp of the faith, but a considered, mature, adult awareness of what their faith stood for and what it meant. And in this, as in all the ingredients that underpinned their vision, obedience to Christ was the bottom line, seeking his will with a view to actually doing it. The word that comes to this faithful church in Philadelphia is a word of encouragement and a reminder of the context within which they fight the good fight. And that context is the assurance of victory. They need to have no doubt that they're serving God, doing the right thing, embracing the right priorities, and that whatever the pressures now, whatever the dangers and the sacrifices, they have allied themselves with the truth and with love, and there's where the victory lies. There is no need to be anxious about the outcome, for with truth and love and goodness and with the spiritual life of the Christian faith comes the glory and the joy of knowing that nothing can prevail against that energy, that beauty, that reality. Sometimes we need to hear that. Say to ourselves like Peter, "Where else can we go, Lord? You alone have the word of life." That's what we're dealing with, the word of life. It made good listening for those Philadelphians living on the edges of the Badlands, the assurance of victory and reward. Not that this is why they worked for the king and the kingdom, for reward, any more than that was why any of the great workers for God made the sacrifices and took on the challenges that they did. But it is the reality, the bonus, as it were, part of the reality of God. He is no man's debtor, nor woman's either. And if we have a share in the work of his church, that's our privilege and our blessing. And whatever the cost, the sacrifices now, the lovely pictures of this letter in Revelation remind us that in the end there will be no regrets, no feeling of being cheated. Indeed, that hope is summed up in the picture of the pillars expressed in the letter. It was the practice in the ancient temples to inscribe the names of the great and the glorious on the pillars of the temple, a kind of enduring mark of respect and acknowledgement, the name living on, kind of in the way plaques and inscriptions in churches celebrate some great figures of the past. And of course, the idea has been taken over into the idiom of someone being a pillar of the kirk. That's an idea that's been somewhat caricatured so that the pillar of the kirk is sometimes represented as a kind of self-righteous, severe, censorious sort of figure. And it has been said that that kind of pillar of the kirk, they're the people who hold everything up. But in truth, there have been and there are plenty of pillars in the truest and best sense, serving Christ and working tirelessly for the church. We know them and we have known them. Those whose love for Jesus, whose commitment to his cause and whose concern for others is unquestionable and powerfully motivated, expressed in Christian service. Not all upfront or obvious, but discreet, humble and immensely effective. Pillars of the kirk, without whose support, strength of faith and graciousness, little would be achieved within the life of the church. Sometimes, as no doubt happened with these Christians in Philadelphia, it all got a bit too much. They felt the threats and the dangers and encountered the disappointments, found their enthusiasm dented by the indifference and unbelief of those they were reaching out to, calling to faith. And the task that faced them seemed daunting, overwhelming and endless. They needed to be told as their resolve shuddered and trembled. And the message of the Spirit of Christ to them is unequivocal in its note of encouragement and support. They needed to be told that their work was not in vain, but was being carried out in the name and the power of Christ, his gospel, his victory, and that they will rejoice in the reward he gives his faithful servants. And he will give them a glory and a name, the privilege of belonging to him, identified forever with him. Maybe when you were little, you used to write in your school book, "This book belongs to Lawrence Twaddle, 14 Finlay Drive, Denniston, Glasgow, Scotland, the United Kingdom, Europe, the world, the universe." As we live this life, and when this life is over, what he promises to his children, what he affirms will be his gift to all who serve him within the witness and life of his church, is this assurance: "She is my woman. He is my man. They belong to me. They are with me, for their life belongs to God." His recognition of loyalty shown and service done: "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter now into the joy of your Lord." That's all we need, want, or could ask for. For us, as for the church long ago, the door to mission is wide, wide open. The summons to loyal service is given by the same Christ who calls us to the constant way of witness, and the promise is firm and unwavering that in serving him we will find the way to joy unspeakable, full of glory. Count me in.